Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome President of Columbia University, Lee Bollinger.
Thank you. It's really an honor to be able to open this conference and to have an evening to celebrate Alan Rosenfield. You can't, I think, celebrate Alan enough. And that is certainly a lesson that we have learned at this institution over the course of the many months that have passed since his tragic death. We've had a number of occasions to do what we're doing tonight. And yet, at every single one, one feels anew, in a sense, the spirit that Alan brought to this university and to the field of public health and to the projects around the world. I have said many times, but again, I'm going to say it once more, that Alan was really my introduction, my teacher, to the world of global public health and more, which is going to be how I actually conclude these very brief remarks. So my wife and I traveled with Alan to Bangladesh to look at the project on arsenic in tube wells. We traveled with him to Ghana and other African countries to look at the maternal mortality projects and other projects. And it was the time we spent together that was really extremely meaningful and has been the base for a lot of what I think and do today. Getting him off of the email was always difficult, and I just remember hours and hours and hours on flights where everybody else had the shades drawn and they were sleeping in business class, and Alan was at work sending out emails, not sending them, but putting them together so as soon as it touched the ground, they were sent out. Linda Fried has done a fantastic job of carrying forward and expanding and building upon the base that Alan brought to the Mailman School of Public Health. And in her very quiet but very, very determined way, and with her very special knowledge, especially in areas of aging population, she has really brought to the university and certainly to the school a sense of purpose that we count on the school, the Mailman School of Public Health, to bring. And this conference, I know I've heard Linda speak about it for many months, and it is a vision of trying to sort of relaunch, in a sense, global public health and to think about it afresh. And there's nothing that I'm happier to sign on to than that. The Claire family, we continue to extend our love and condolences. Global public health, I think of as part of a context of the emergence of a global society. I have what some people may feel is an exaggerated view of what's happening in the world, but my basic view is that the forces of free markets and capitalism and trade in goods and services are driving fantastic changes in the world. And a lot of this is very, very good. It is bringing hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and disease and into a life of basic human decency. But it's also bringing enormous problems. Climate change is one obvious example. The problems of global financial regulation, certainly another. I mean, we're just now still emerging from the deepest economic recession and since the Depression. And I think what's happening is that we are in the process of building the foundations for a new kind of global society if all of this continues to work. Now, the forces against it are very strong, and they are manifold. I mean, they are very, very powerful. And the possibilities of conflict between nations and the loss of the tremendous potential of this greater and greater integration is something that we need to work on strenuously. At the same time, we need to try to build those institutions that are necessary to make a really good global society. It's just absolutely essential that we do this. My own field is freedom of speech and press, and up until 2 years ago, I was happily going along, knowing every single case out of the Supreme Court in the last 90 years, 80 years, no, 90. I know every single case, and I know it really well. And there's nothing you can trick me on. And I've taught it again and again and again for several decades. The problem is, I suddenly realized as I was writing a little book about the history of freedom of speech and press in the United States, that it's no longer just about freedom of speech and press in the United States. It's about how do you establish some kind of principles about free speech and free press around the world. We are now every day confronting new problems where one society thinks one way about free press and other societies think other ways, and there is conflict as a result. Even more importantly, we simply do not have the information we need coming out of the press in the world in order to build this global society. Everything really depends upon information and ideas and analyses. And our great newspapers, our great broadcast networks are cutting back on foreign bureaus and foreign correspondents, and we have less foreign coverage than we have ever had at the very moment when we need it the most. And so I've set off to try to do this, and next week in this room will be my conference on trying to think about how do you build a global free press for this global world, and thinking about that afresh. We had just a couple of weeks ago in this room the Committee on Global Thought trying to think about the enormous power of sovereign wealth funds and how do we take that capacity and convince countries to use that for long-term social good and not just for immediate profit maximizing. And we have other conferences in the works at this institution that focus on climate, environment, global financial regulation, and on and on. Now, I hear people say Basel III is going to have a profound effect on lending in developing countries. And we don't know yet what is going to really happen, but this could have consequences for impoverished peoples around the world. I have two big points here. One is that this university is absolutely committed to trying to take every facet of this new world we are in and to devote our resources to trying to understand it and to do research on it and to teach the next generation. And we now have global centers, we're calling them, in five or six regions around the world, all dedicated to facilitating research projects on these subjects. The second point is not just about this university, but it's about these big problems. And the point I have made for the past five, 6 years, and I make it again tonight, is that public health has been out there doing this for decades. That's what I learned from Alan Rosenfield. You have been really the leaders trying to forge a global society from one of the most important ways in which we think about humanity. Now, in my view, you have to lead not just with public health, but with global free press, with sovereign wealth funds, with Basel III, with economic regulation, with climate and environment, because you are out there, you know what is going on, and you need to help the rest of us to understand how to do this better. So I am here on a Sunday night. I never do anything on a Sunday night. I take it as my one day when I can say no to people. And I have a specialty, as every president does, in opening conferences. So I am called on frequently to exercise that very special capacity that I have developed, which, as you know, is largely meaningless. But for this, for Linda, for Alan, and for this subject, I'm here for this purpose this evening. Congratulations to all of you. And now it's my pleasure to give you Jack Rowe. And Jack has taught me about something that's also very, very important to me, and that is how, when you think about global public health, you got to think about the consequences of this new emerging wealth that this global, wonderful global economy is creating, and the consequences of that with staggering effects on diseases that and health conditions that come from wealth, unfortunately. And so he has really helped to reorient us in that direction broadly across the university. He has a fabulous background. He's done everything. He's done it exceedingly well. He's a charming person. You know, if we could all be Jack Rowe, we'd really be well off. I now give you Jack Rowe.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Lee. I get an exceedingly positive and generous recommendation when he starts, introduction, when he starts by forgetting to introduce me. Did you notice that? It really works every time. I'm the chairman of the board of the Mailman School, and in that capacity, it's a pleasure and honor to invite and to welcome all of you to this very important conference on the changing landscape of global public health. As President Bollinger referred to, this is something that the School of Public Health has been focused on for a very long time. And in fact, over the last several decades, our faculty have worked in 102 countries to improve the health status of individuals and to build health systems. It is my pleasure specifically to introduce Linda Fried. Linda is a Delmar Professor and Dean of the Mailman School of Public Health here at Columbia. She's a recognized and highly respected scholar in the field of gerontology and geriatrics, and particularly she built over the course of several years and maybe decades a systematic body of work on the origin and the underlying mechanisms and approaches to the prevention and the reversal of human frailty. A very, very important contribution for which she was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. On the other side, beyond the pure scholarship, because much of what we do in public health is about practical applications of scholarship, Linda was the co-founder of Experience Corps, which is a public service, a volunteer program for older adults with disadvantaged public school children, which has been proven to be effective in enhancing the performance of the children and enhancing the health status and well-being of the older volunteers. It's now in 20 cities and 200 schools and is really making a tremendous difference. Alan Rosenfield established a fabulous platform for the Mailman School going forward. He positioned the Mailman School for success. And Linda Fried has proved herself since the middle of 2008 when she joined us from Johns Hopkins as a fitting successor to Alan. We have entered onto a period of very substantial growth in our academic programs, in our research programs. Our grants are up 46%, and our educational programs Our student body has grown by a full third in the 2 years that she's been here. Alan would be very proud. Linda Fried.
Thanks to both of you. That was an exceedingly gracious introduction. In addition, both of your tremendous enthusiasm and support for the work of Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health, and particularly your profound support for the goals of the 2 days ahead of us, are very important. I'm here to welcome all of you, in particular, to this very exciting evening and to the beginning of how it sets up a major global visioning exercise for the next 2 days, which we intend to have great impact. But first, to Claire Rosenfield and the other members of Alan's family who are here, and to his many friends and former colleagues who are here with us, thank you so much for joining us tonight and for the ongoing support and wisdom that you have offered to me since I've taken on the deanship of this fabulous school. My job has been made easier because I'm standing on the shoulders of a visionary giant who was also a man of action. The faculty he assembled and collaborations he initiated around the world, the students he attracted and taught, who are now leaders in our field, are the intellectual capital that make our institution and our partnerships rich beyond measure. I also want to join President Bollinger in extending a warm welcome to our colleagues who have traveled here from around the world to attend our meeting over the next 2 days on the changing landscape of global public health. This working meeting of leaders of global public health has been 2 years in the making. Sitting among us tonight are public health practitioners and advocates who work on the front lines every day, as President Bollinger was saying. Researchers who build the knowledge base that must be an essential prerequisite for global policy and action. Educators who are training the young men and women who will rise to positions of leadership in global health as the world's populations are shaped by seismic demographic and health shifts that we know lay ahead. We have with us policymakers at the levers of decision making, who together with foundation leadership affect the directions and investing of resources that have a profound effect on all of our directions and what work, what needs, we even have the support to act on. And we have members of the private sector here whose vision, business decisions, and whose generosity can shape essential characteristics of the world we live in. And you come from 32 countries around the world today. I want to also take a moment to thank the people who have been engines behind this conference over the last 2 years. The leadership of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and our colleagues, all of the deans of the Association of Schools of Public Health. And I want to thank the Mailman School's organizing committee under the leadership of Dr. Richard Parker, who have worked, this sounds hackneyed, but in this case it's true, who have worked tirelessly and with great strategic vision to convene this extraordinary assemblage of leaders of global public health. While many of you have just had a very long trip, our journey together has only begun, as of a few minutes ago. In the next 2 days, through vigorous and engaging dialogue and some real roll-up-your-sleeves hard work together, we hope to move towards an action agenda that lays out a vision for the next generation of global public health leadership that will be equal to the challenges that are on the horizon, both over the short term and the long term, and that align them. Because those challenges are quite substantial, as everyone in this audience knows. They're not replacing the many challenges that we have been facing now for decades. Rather, they add new dimensions on top of work not yet done. With Alan's great leadership and the hard work and skills of thousands in public health around the globe, we have made significant progress in many, many areas, but not enough. Maternal and infant mortality are still at unacceptable levels. Malaria, TB, and AIDS continue to ravage global populations. And yet, in the face of that, new problems with astonishing speed are emerging. The key question ahead of us for this conference is to understand how the world's health needs are changing and how to add, absorb, and encompass into a broad agenda the new challenges that are being added on. Obesity, diabetes, heart disease, mental health problems, injuries, all significant. Perhaps we can find a way into this complexity by understanding the breadth of the problems. And as we know, things like non-communicable diseases are actually communicable. As our Western lifestyle spreads around the world, it brings health impacts with it, and they are not consistently good. At the same time, we're living longer as a result of the profound successes of public health, medicine, and education, a tremendous global victory, these longer lives. And our longer lives should be bringing critical benefits to all of us in every age group and to our economies and productivity if we live in health. But longer life also gives time for emerging chronic conditions to appear and makes prevention and the public health agenda ever more critical. Our global world actually spreads supposedly non-communicable disease by the contagion of tobacco and other lifestyle shifts. Other changing factors have already been mentioned. I'll gloss over them because of that, but they are huge. Urbanization, climate change, water shortages, and heat, and changing patterns of disease and migration will no doubt lead to increasing public health emergencies, and the solutions require long-term approaches, not just after the fact emergent solutions. And everything, of course, is accelerated by the smaller world we live in. Airplanes brought many of you here to New York tonight, but we know, of course, that airplanes also carry infectious diseases and can spread an epidemic globally at a terrifying speed. So we have multiple challenges ahead of us. They demand a long-term vision to find the most effective, efficient, and innovative solutions for the most people. Public health, which I call global health for the public good, must be a leader in shaping that vision. During the 2 days of the changing landscape of global public health, which we are all engaged in together, we will seek to frame some new perspectives, generate new thinking, and identify new forms of action to ensure the health of the world's populations in coming decades. With all of us together at the table, I think that we can accomplish what none of us can do alone and establish important ongoing momentum towards solutions. Alan, I think, would have loved to have been a part of this. And he is, because we're looking to these challenges and the intellectual complexity that they pose with Alan's values, his courage, his persistence, his belief in innovative thinking and challenging what we assume, and collaborative action. We carry his standard, and that is why this evening, to honor advance Alan's legacy, is so fitting as the start of our conference tomorrow and an inspiration for the work that lies ahead to lay out future directions. As this group knows so well, Alan was an obstetrician and a gynecologist who obtained his medical degree here at Columbia. He began his global health work in the 1960s in Nigeria and Thailand and worked tirelessly over 4 decades with his wife Claire and his family and so many of the people in the room on women's reproductive health and rights, innovative family planning studies, and strategies to solve unnecessary maternal deaths and prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV/AIDS. Alan was an iconic and a visionary leader. He called us to task, and he inspired us to action. When Alan asked, "Where is the M in MCH?" he expanded the focus on child survival to include the survival of the mother. Dr. Rosenfield and colleagues around the world who shared his vision launched the Safe Motherhood Movement after that, and ever since, this university has played a critical role in the call for universal access to life-saving emergency obstetric care. Similarly, Alan's landmark plenary talk at the International AIDS Conference in Durban, South Africa in 2000, which was entitled "Where is the M in MTCT?" focused global attention on the irony of attempting to prevent HIV transmission from a mother with HIV to her infant while forgetting the mother's own health and survival. The MTCT Plus initiative was established to address this disparity, and ICAP, the International Center for AIDS Programs, was built on its foundations. Alan and Dr. Wafa El-Sadr's mother-to-child transmission program has brought comprehensive health care to prevent transmission of AIDS to more than 500,000 women and infants. Alan's legacy is more than alive. It is being carried forward by many in the room today and to the minute. A notable example comes from Mailman School professors of clinical epidemiology, Salim S. Abdul-Karim and Quraysha Abdul-Karim, who reported at July's AIDS conference their breakthrough findings that the use of a gel containing the antiretroviral drug tenofovir reduced a woman's chance of becoming infected with HIV during sex by 39% compared with a control group that used a placebo gel. If the study results are supported by further studies, the researchers estimate that widespread use of the gel could prevent over 500,000 new HIV infections in South Africa alone over the next decade. So tonight, in the spirit of this conference, we honor the legacy of Dean Rosenfield. To do that, we recognize that we all stand on his shoulders and extend his legacy by envisioning the next generation of his work and developing clarity about his vision and how his vision and accomplishments need to be advanced in coming years. Among many global initiatives organized from this school during Dr. Rosenfield's tenure, two are particularly celebrated here tonight. AMDD, the Averting Maternal Death and Disability Program, which is now led by Professor Lynn Friedman, addresses the central women's health and rights issue in dozens of countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And ICAP, the International Center for AIDS Care and Treatment Programs, led by Dr. Wafa El-Sadr, that recently celebrated a truly remarkable milestone of 1 million individuals in sub-Saharan Africa receiving HIV services through ICAP-supported programs. Within this School of Public Health, we remain committed to Alan's legacy, to its continuing, and in fact, to expanding it, to the issues of tonight and to global health broadly. A school that he brought to maturity has partners in over 100 countries around the world. I am delighted, as part of advancing our commitment to Alan's legacy, that we have initiated a new global health initiative at the Mailman School of Public Health to bring together the expertise of faculty within the school and more widely across the university, and with long-standing partners globally to bring cutting-edge and multidisciplinary insight to some of the greatest global health challenges of our time. This exciting initiative, which is designed to bring the work of this school to ever greater benefit to global health in collaboration with our colleagues globally, is being led by Dr. Wafa El-Sadr, Director, and Dr. Alastair Ager, Executive Director. So it is now my honor to turn the program for the evening over to the two co-chairs to honor Alan Rosenfield and the vision of those who are continuing his work. I'm delighted to begin by introducing Professor Lynn Friedman. Lynn is Professor of Clinical Population and Family Health at the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. A human rights lawyer and public health expert, Professor Friedman is a longtime collaborator with Alan Rosenfield on many issues of women's rights and women's health. She now directs the Mailman School's Averting Maternal Death and Disability Program, a global program of research, policy analysis, implementation science, and technical support that since 1999 has worked with UN agencies, NGOs, and governments in more than 50 countries to reduce maternal mortality. Lynn.
Thank you so much, Linda, and let me also thank the wonderful Wafa El-Sadr for the privilege of co-chairing this evening with her. I hope soon they will put up the next slide. There it is. Our bodies are selves. He believed it. He never, ever was afraid to say it. For Alan Rosenfield, individual dignity of men, and most urgently of women, individual dignity and social justice were the values that lay at the foundation, at the very core of public health. He proudly stood at rallies like this one. But perhaps his most enduring legacy to us was that he understood that the battle was not won only on the street. In the practice of public health, in research, in programs, in policymaking, in evidence-based advocacy, he knew we had the tools to generate change so long as we had the vision of what change would look like in a rapidly transforming world. And as certain as Alan was in his own moorings, in his own commitment to these values, and as sure as he was of his own ability to get things done, he also understood that change would happen only when we built a public health practice that gave voice to others, to the people on the ground who struggled with life and death in health systems, in social systems that were profoundly unjust. He knew that change would happen only when we reached across the many divides that fracture our world, and we listened, truly listened, as we created broad and inclusive movements. There was something a little bit magical in Alan's qualities as a leader at a school of public health. As persistent as he was in his own views, and my, we all here know he could certainly be persistent, he knew also how to give his colleagues space, a space to dream themselves, each to bring their own talents and determination, their own unique expression to the goals that we shared, the goals that we set and questioned and transformed in dialogue together. And that, to get the best from others, to give the space to create and contribute from their own talents and potential, that in the end is perhaps the real definition of a great educator, as Alan certainly was. And so Alan would have taken very special pride tonight in the next part of our program. Christy Turlington Burns may be best known as one of the world's top fashion models. A full-page photo even graces this morning's New York Times. But she is fast becoming known as something else, as an untiring advocate for ending maternal mortality, for the right of every woman, wherever she lives, to have access to the life-saving services that can enable her to go through pregnancy and childbirth safely, to survive and to thrive. Of course, Alan would have been most pleased to have any celebrity take up this issue. But Christy has really done it differently. As you will see in the next few moments, she took her own terrifying experience of a complication in childbirth, and she began to ask, what happens to women in the world who don't have the incredible privileges of access to care that we in this country so often take for granted? As an ambassador for care, Christy had the chance to visit a program that we in AMDD and CARE had together implemented high in the Andes Mountains in Peru. And she saw there what a rights-based approach to maternal mortality could do to transform the services for marginalized indigenous populations. So she decided to use her own resources and connections, I would say her own hidden talents, the ones that you actually don't see on the runway or in a jewelry ad, use those talents to really create, to direct, a film that would explore what does happen for women who are marginalized and excluded from life-saving care. In rural Tanzania, where physical distance, poverty, and an under-resourced health system put emergency care beyond the reach of so many. She filmed in the urban slums of Bangladesh, where social distance becomes an equally powerful barrier. In the health system of Guatemala, where the laws that criminalize abortion mean a death sentence for women who cannot buy their way out. And in our own backyard, here in the U.S., where the very wealth of our country highlights the shame, the utter shame of a system that cannot and does not provide equitable care for all. And in that process, Christy has opened her own life to the powerful message that can come from a politically committed practice of public health. And I'm sure Alan would be thrilled to know that she has become indeed an MPH student here at the Mailman School. Alan would have been very proud indeed. So friends and colleagues, we join in Alan's spirit and are also proud to present tonight an excerpt from No Woman, No Cry, and Christy Turlington Burns. Thank you.
Thank you.
Turlington Burns.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Though our paths only crossed very briefly in the summer of 2008 before I started classes here at Mailman, he clearly made a mark. Alan left an impression on me, and at the time that we were finishing editing the film, I felt very strongly about having it be dedicated to his memory, and was very happy that Claire agreed to let us do that, to honor him. As Lynn mentioned before, the film includes a few other countries, Bangladesh, Guatemala, and also the U.S. I shared my plans with Alan. I met with him and told him what I'd hoped to achieve in making a documentary film, and he was incredibly supportive and gave me lists and lists of people who were working on other films in the area and people who I should talk to and who I should meet. And it took me about 2 years to finish this film. I'm a little emotional in seeing it here with all of you. It gives me such pleasure to think that it is useful already in serving the work that you did in the memory of Alan's work. So I thank you very much for having me here, and I hope to continue to do whatever I can as an advocate, as a student of public health, as a mother, and as a human being to reduce the deaths that are so unnecessary and tragic. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great.
So it is now my very special pleasure and privilege to introduce Claire Rosenfield, poet, artist, social worker, teacher, healer, committed advocate for women, activist for justice, gender, and otherwise, lifelong partner to Alan, loving mother to Paul and Jill, proud grandmother to a growing hoard, loyal friend, and fierce advocate for the Mailman School. How did Alan get so lucky? Anyone who knows Claire, indeed, anyone who gets Claire's emails knows that she not only shared so many of Alan's passions, she absolutely recreated them into her own very special style and voice. And she added a few more passions of her own. So, with great admiration and respect for all that you have done, I welcome Claire Rosenfield.
Oh, what can I add to this beautiful, beautiful event with all these magnificent speakers? Only that I am deeply, deeply grateful. So grateful to all of you, to Dean Linda Fried for having such thoughtfulness to plan for this incredible event, to President Bollinger for always being there to support everything that Alan ever wanted to do, and now everything that the Mailman School is continuing to do to advance Alan's vision and their own vision. Alan, right from the age of 11, I have his diary, said, "When I grow up, I plan to be a doctor." So I know that his planning was his expertise, and planning, not only planning, but to put things into action, as you have seen. I don't need to add anything more, except one thing I wanted to just mention, and that is that he would see someone in pain, or a whole country suffering, or a whole group of people suffering, and his heart was moved. So his motivation came from his heart, and he just jumped into action. It was just an amazing feat. He was tireless, and I can see that the people in this Mailman School of Public Health are continuing to be dedicated and tireless and compassionate. And I am so privileged to know so many of you in this field of public health and in all aspects of Columbia University. I feel deeply honored to know you. And I want to say a special thank you to Mrs. Mailman and Josh and Jody for their foresight and enthusiasm in always supporting the School of Public Health and in naming the School of Public Health after their beautiful late Joseph Mailman, because without their gift, the school couldn't have flourished as it has already to this day. So I am just I'm just here to say thank you, and I will look forward to seeing whatever of this conference gets streamed on the web, because it is extraordinary, the gathering of this group of experts from North and South. And I would just love to meet every one of you, and I hope that afterwards you will come up and introduce yourselves, because meeting people from all over the world and people that are so into all of these wonderful fields of public health is one of my greatest joys. So thank you. Alan would have been so thrilled, and I'm sure from some star, some sunshine, some galaxy, he is watching and thanking you all as well. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Wafa El-Sadr.
Good evening, and thank you, Claire, for all your hard work to bring peace, love, harmony, and justice to this world. And good evening, colleagues and friends. I'm really honored to talk to you today, and in particular, I've been very honored to co-chair this whole event with my dear friend, Lynn Friedman, and to have worked with a wonderful group of people through the planning process for today's event. In today's world, we are inured to superlatives. They have been used too freely and have lost their power. One is the word courage. What is courage? Courage is the ability to confront fear, pain, risk, uncertainty, or intimidation. Moral courage is the remarkable quality to act rightly in the face of popular opposition or active discouragement. In that context, it is instructive to reflect back on the tumultuous history of the HIV epidemic and the watershed moment in 2000 when Alan asked the penetratingly simple question, where is the M in MTCT? This was a time when courage was needed. Conventional wisdom then said that nothing could be done for the millions of people living with HIV in poor countries around the world. Nothing could be done for these families. Nothing could be done for this lost generation. Their only legacy, it was held, would be memories of tears, pain, and indescribable suffering. And this conventional wisdom gripped the minds not only of outsiders to medicine and public health, but of too many of our own leaders as well. To challenge this conventional wisdom took not only great insight, but courage, moral courage. Alan Rosenfield was a beacon in the struggle. He persevered where it would have been easier to stand to the side. He advocated for the MTCT Plus initiative as we built these programs. He proved the naysayers wrong. Alan was there too as we established and built ICAP on that foundation. Look about you tonight and you will see around this august hall just a few images of the work of ICAP in Africa within the display cases around this hall. This work celebrates Alan's courage, the courage of those working day in and day out to save lives. The images also show the courage of those who stand up every day, proclaiming without shame or hesitation that they have HIV. ICAP's work in hamlets, villages, townships, and cities puts global health into action, from evidence to practice to impact, just the type of work that Alan would have championed. Courage is also the first word that comes to my mind when one thinks of our next speaker, Jerry Kovadia. I first met Jerry more than 20 years ago, during some of the darkest years in the history of South Africa, the apartheid years. Jerry was then and remains today an eminent professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, a prominent immunologist and researcher focusing on the health of Africa's children. But that is just one small piece of the whole of Jerry's being. Jerry has that quality of mind which shows itself in facing danger with bravery, boldness, and passion. In those dark years, Jerry was determined in challenging the illegitimate government of the day without compromise or fear. He led a small but powerful group of progressive physicians, many of whom remain dear colleagues of mine to this day, who came together to form an alternate physicians' organization in response to revelations of complicity by doctors in the torture and death of activists. Like most political activists, he was harassed and intimidated, but nothing would stop him in the March of Destiny, a march that culminated in that memorable day in February of 1990, when the world watched in awe and wonderment as Nelson Mandela took those first steps of freedom after 27 years of brutal imprisonment. With the fall of apartheid, Jerry continued with the dawn of this new era in his tireless efforts, now contributing to the building of the new South Africa. For his courage, he was honored in 2000 with the Star of South Africa by then President Nelson Mandela. I am indeed honored now to welcome Jerry Kovadia as our next speaker, professor, scientist, researcher, leader, mentor, and activist. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you very much, Wafaya, and thank you to the organizers for having me here. I had prepared a speech, but I'm afraid much of what I wanted to say and convey to you about the dramas I have witnessed in a country like South Africa have already been more explicitly and more imaginatively portrayed by the film that you have seen and the words you have heard. So I'm going to tell you about what Alan's work meant to me and to many of my colleagues who Wafa spoke about, and in South Africa, but also in the rest of Africa. First of all, I'm really glad that Alan didn't take up private practice and he went into public health, because really that very fact that he struggled with the problems of the poor and looked at the broader areas of human suffering led to the collaborations with us and led to his influence on numbers of people whom I can't even mention. He had the impulses to care for many people, not just a few. And those same impulses fired us in our struggle in Southern Africa and Africa as a whole. It fired us with a passion that he also had. It fired us with the determination he had. And in some ways, I think he's influenced the successes we've had, in at least in my country. I must try and give an example of the sort of impact, the sustained impact his influence has had. He's a man of extraordinary perception. And I don't know if my friend Zena Stein is in the audience, but she was describing, we have a Nobel laureate in literature called Nadine Gordimer. And she said her unique quality as a human being is she can see in the dark. And that's exactly what Alan does. He sees in the dark. Long before the events arise, he can see, he can perceive the sort of problems that are about to arise. So what is his impact now, today? Well, there are four or five major epidemics in my country. The one epidemic is the problem of maternal, newborn children and women's health. The second one is HIV/AIDS, and the third is violence, and the fourth is a lack of equity. We are the most unequal nation on earth. And if you think about the moment about what Alan stood for, it's in perfect concordance with all the values he held. He held the values of human rights, the values of equity, and the values for women's rights in an unequal world for women. So his perceptions and his ideas are valid today as the first time he ever formed them. He had a particular interest in maternal mortality, and so have I. And I have watched in with great interest what's been happening. He would have been slightly, minimally relieved to know that global maternal mortality is decreasing, although women with HIV die more often than women without HIV. But he'd be appalled by the fact that in my continent, sub-Saharan Africa, we contribute a huge proportion. We used to contribute about 23% of global maternal mortality. He'd be really shocked to know that at the moment, 2008, we contribute a higher figure, 57%. And so on and so forth. He would have been really scandalized by the fact that in South Africa, we could have averted many of the problems if we had simply had a government which listened to science and listened to reason. And I had many discussions with him as we fought against that medieval view about the meaning of science and the meaning of evidence. And I'm particularly involved in mother-to-child transmission and all the things you heard about these narrow, reductionist views about mother-to-child transmission are entirely true. And I was one of those, not victims, I was one of those culprits. I grew up as a pediatrician. I worked as a pediatrician. And when it came to the opportunity to reduce mother-to-child transmission, that's exactly what I did. It didn't occur to me for a moment, given the context in which I grew up and which I was trained in the conventional ways of medicine, that I should be bothered about women. Not for a second. And here I was, not like Alan, living in New York. I was living in the very heat of that epidemic, in the very throes of the suffering that women were going through. We rationalized at that time that we simply couldn't afford antiretrovirals, but that was an escape route. When it came to injustice and oppression, we fought against that, despite the fact that our weapons were weak and we had nothing except our determination and our human rights to fight for. But we didn't fight for women in the same way. And it's only much later that we began to think, when the World Health Organization came out with a comprehensive plan of looking at mother-to-child transmission, we began to think wider than that. But as you've heard from a number of speakers, Alan was way ahead of us. He had already published, where is the M in MTCT? Where is the mother in the mother-to-child transmission? And I'm really glad to say that he'd be pleased as anything to see today the impact of those sorts of views which he had the prescience and the foresight to think about long before many of us who were in the very heart of the struggle for justice and good health of women. So that had a great impact. And lastly, I must say that people like Alan are really rare. And to have met him, to have worked with him, I sat with him on the board of a body called AMFA, and I saw him at the good times and I saw him at the worst times. To the courage he conveyed to all of us to continue to fight for what we believe was right and what was in the best interests of the people, at least in sub-Saharan Africa and in much of the world, it's been a privilege to have been part of that. Alan has those rare qualities I already spoke about, but he would have been pleased in some ways and challenged in some ways about the current trends of what might be happening to global health. It's quite clear to me that the capacity of national governments to deal with many problems, not just health, the economies, etc., are being superseded by globalization in many ways, so that national sovereignty is becoming less important than the sovereignty of transnational corporations. And I think for us, many of us personally, and for my colleagues in the developing world, Alan proved one thing, that globalization may have many discontents, but people like him allow us to believe in the exchange and the interconnectedness and solidarity of people across national borders. So I've been really very pleased and honored to have known him. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jerry. Vision and commitment are two other words that are too easily used today. Some would define visionary as someone who indulges in fantastic ideas or schemes, maybe of impractical nature. Others would define a visionary as a person with the ability of great perceptions and who can see the future with remarkable clarity. Commitment, the other word we use too often, is the absolute moral choice of a course of action. Stephen Lewis, our next speaker, epitomizes these two words in their true meaning, commitment and vision. Stephen and Alan were brothers in arms. At that watershed moment in the history of the global HIV epidemic in 2000, Stephen joined Alan in a call for action. Serving as the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa, Stephen articulated as no one had to date the agony and the suffering of millions with HIV. In his visits to some of the most severely affected countries in Africa, Stephen did not just rub shoulders with the powerful. He took the time to sit on the floor of thatched huts, listening to the voices of the women and the men, and keenly observing their struggle to maintain their dignity against all odds. Stephen saw in their eyes a deep determination to save their families and to save their communities, if only given a chance. He became their voice and took their words to the halls of power around the world. Now, no platitudes from the big and powerful could assuage Stephen. He spoke to whoever was willing to listen, and even those who were not willing. Little did he care that his honesty and directness might make some squirm with discomfort, and squirm they did. Stephen's is a dogged commitment that never rests. His is a commitment that we surely need as we look ahead to the challenges of tomorrow in our quest to vanquish this epidemic. He recognizes that many millions living with HIV have yet to gain access to life-saving treatments, that many women have still to access care for themselves and their children, and that many continue to get newly infected. In short, that our work is not done and that we cannot rest comfortably on our laurels. Now, Stephen's role as the conscience of the world for the HIV epidemic was not a newly found ethos acquired late in life. His trajectory over a long and illustrious career provides remarkable snapshots. As a young student at the University of Toronto, Stephen was part of a debating team that almost beat then-Senator John F. Kennedy as they debated on the question of, has the U.S. failed in its responsibility as a world leader? Not surprisingly, young Stephen's debating performance was acknowledged as the highlight of the event. I only wish I could find a photograph, but I couldn't. He went on to lead Ontario New Democratic Party to become Canada's ambassador to the United Nations, followed by serving at leadership roles at UNICEF. His public service was acknowledged in 2003 with his investiture into the Order of Canada, Canada's highest honor for lifetime achievement. Stephen currently serves as co-director of AIDS Free World, a new advocacy organization that he established, working towards a more urgent and effective global response to the epidemic. While some spend their time working towards identifying a cure for HIV infection or in efforts to control the epidemic, Stephen's vision is truly of an AIDS-free world. He can see this world. It is not just a fanciful wish or an impractical dream. With Stephen's dogged commitment, I am confident that we can reach this vision. Now, at a recent International AIDS conference, I was among many thousands who sat through the opening ceremony, listening to speaker after speaker. As the evening got later and later, many started to leave the hall. I joined them, keenly aware of the plenary talk that I was scheduled to deliver early the following morning. As we all walked away from the hall, I suddenly heard Stephen's voice as he began to address the attendees. I stopped in my tracks and swiftly turned around, determined to quickly make my way back, seeking not to miss one word. I was not the only one. Many others around me joined me as we streamed back and silently took our seats, again, listened to Stephen. Each of us knew that we needed to listen, to regain our equilibrium, and to re-energize our souls for the coming challenges. It is my great pleasure tonight to welcome Stephen Lewis, our keynote speaker, voice of our conscience, advocate, leader, and our brother in arms. Welcome.
That is, without doubt, the most extravagant introduction I have ever received in my feckless life. And I am tremendously appreciative both of the kindness and generosity of Wafa, but also her mastery of the art of gentle hyperbole. I'm so privileged, Claire and the entire family, to be here tonight and to participate in this overture to the conference which follows. I was much taken by President Bollinger when he said that you can't celebrate Alan enough, and the time that you spent together was extremely meaningful, and I thought back to all the extraordinary opportunities that I had had to spend time with Alan, who became such a friend and such a mentor. I must say, President Bollinger, that I am not as sanguine as you are about the free trade forces of capitalism refurbishing the world, but I shall not allow myself the ideological spasm to which I am normally addicted. And I will simply use the words of Jerry Kovadia, noting the role of transnational corporations. I appreciated very much that Jack Rowe talked of the fabulous platform in going forward, which was the legacy of Alan's architecture. I appreciated Linda Fried talking of the changing landscape of global public health and the visions that are required for the next generation, a vision I would not presume to reconnoiter, but a vision which clearly will emerge, at least in part, from the conversations over the next 2 days. I love hearing Lynn Friedman because of her extraordinary commitment to human rights and inevitably, therefore, describing Alan so appropriately as a man committed to the individual dignity of the human persona, of the human being at the heart of his commitment. It is indeed the scope of Alan's vision. And I don't doubt for a moment that he was magical in his qualities as a leader. Christy Turlington Burns, your film is remarkable. I salute you for it. And I thought that the line in the middle of the film or towards the end of the film, that losing one member of the family is losing everyone, was a line that imprints itself on one's consciousness memorably. And Claire. Claire, a fierce advocate of Melbourne, it was said. Claire is a fierce advocate for everything that touches on social justice. And I thought coming from Claire, the sense of Alan as someone who would see pain in an individual or a country or a collectivity and feel it in his heart, and that is what propelled him into action, it would be hard to find a better encapsulation of the man. But naturally, Claire would touch that encapsulation better than all the rest of us. And Wafa, I'm not just a fan of Wafa, I'm a positive groupie when it comes to Wafa. And I just can't get over the extraordinary presence she has and the strength that she shows in every avenue and context in which she is a participant. And Jerry Kovadia, I think Jerry knows that I regard him as a hero, and I don't have many heroes because I'm a cynical curmudgeon inching into my dotage, and heroism is not immediately on my mind. But Jerry Kovadia is the embodiment of human decency and principle and courage as I have rarely seen. I love that reference to Nadine Gordimer's phrase, "Sees in the dark," about Alan. And I want to say to all of you, if I may, that because I'm struggling a little, as you may notice, with a throat ailment, I didn't want to risk my tendency to be Castro-like in my speeches and keep you here till the midnight hour. So I took the opportunity to put some thoughts on paper. But I think it's fair to say that my own conviction is that some of the old challenges are still the new challenges. And when I heard Jerry Covadia outline those aspects of South African society which are still being a part of the struggle, I thought, yes, that's what Alan would think. And I believe that what I'm about to say, to some extent, mirrors the struggles that Jerry articulated. All the plaudits and tributes for Alan, genuine and heartfelt from all of us, can never quite capture the essence of the man. So many of his friends and colleagues here knew him far better than did I. But for me, there was a quality that surpassed even the gentle innocence, the astonishing intelligence, the insatiable curiosity, the encyclopedic life experience. Alan cared so very deeply about important issues in a way I had rarely encountered before. I felt it first, as many felt it, when, as you've heard, at a critical moment in the AIDS pandemic, he fashioned and led the initiative to add the plus to prevention of mother-to-child transmission. It was, when you think of it, an organic extension of Where is the M in MCH, reaffirming what preoccupied Alan always. How are mothers treated? How are women treated in the grand panorama of public health, of global public health? He understood immediately that in PMTCT, the emphasis was always on the child, with the health of the mother as an afterthought. Would that Alan were alive today. Little has changed. The preoccupation with ending pediatric AIDS by 2015 is still measured in the numbers of children born HIV positive or HIV negative. Interest in the health and life of the mother is still as much rhetorical fetishism as it is genuine concern. Admittedly, happily, Colombia is different. Colombia, true to Alan, as a matter of policy and principle and driven by ICAP, nurtures the entire family through the ravages of HIV/AIDS. But alas, Colombia is a limited part of the whole. And it gets worse. Many jurisdictions addressing the pandemic still use single-dose nevirapine rather than double or triple combination therapy, whatever the guidelines from the World Health Organization. But we now know from irrefutable studies that single-dose nevirapine can develop resistance in the mother and her infant to future antiretroviral treatment, putting both at great risk. The mother is rarely given a choice. The principle of informed consent is rarely, if ever, to be seen. We don't hear from the World Health Organization or UNAIDS the outrage that should be expressed at this gross violation of human rights. And why don't we hear? Because, as ever, the overriding focus remains on improving the chances for the child. The desperate need to tell the world come 2015 that 80% coverage has been reached in PMTCT. My co-director of AIDS Free World, Paula Donovan, known to many of you, is even now writing an uncompromising monograph documenting this violation of the rights of pregnant HIV-positive women. I know that Alan would have approved. Is it self-centered to introduce AIDS Free World at this point? Not at all. Alan was chair of our advisory board, and in that position, with unfailing tenacity, he championed the rights of women, of sexual and reproductive health of women, and feminist causes. As I survey the landscape today, I think there are four other matters amongst many that would have commanded Alan's attention and built on his legacy. First, the way in which the Millennium Development Goals have given priority to reducing maternal mortality. The heightened awareness, the huge increases in funding, all of it suggests that the world will no longer tolerate the death in childbirth of between 350,000 and 500,000 women every year. The extraordinary film we've just viewed captures in a most evocative and poignant way the struggles of giving birth in impoverished countries. Alan would have been thrilled to think that the world is beginning to care. On the other hand, Alan would have been vigilant. What are we going to do with all the money? And who makes the decisions? My government, the government of Canada, announced as host nation that maternal and child health was to be the centerpiece of the G8 this year. Ironically, the money Canada contributed to a five-year plan equaled almost exactly the money it spent on 3 days of police security for the G8 and G20 meetings. And when they announced the plan, they had no initial idea what they would contribute, or where it would go, or whether family planning would be a part of it, or whether the rights to abortion had to be included. Nothing of emergency obstetric intervention, nothing of midwives, nothing of birth attendants, and interestingly enough, no one challenged them. It was such an ideological mess that it reeked of opportunism. Alan would have raised his appreciable eyebrows and demanded explanations. Second, the creation of the new International Agency for Women. Alan was always excited as we fought for the agency. He knew the United Nations had an abysmal record on women, and he felt, although skeptical of success, that an agency could alter the lives of millions of women. He'd be beside himself to have seen the creation of UN Women just a few weeks ago. I think I should say at this point that although we have an agency, unanimously approved by the General Assembly, probably the single most important UN reform in some 60 years, and ready to go into operation on January the 1st, 2011, it's still going to be a tough battle to put in place the operational capacity on the ground, to raise sufficient funds, we need at least $1 billion by the end of the first year, and to fend off the neurotic rivalries and unbridled ambitions of senior staff in the 4 UN fragments currently dealing with women that are to be folded into UN Women. Our greatest hope is the appointment of Michelle Bachelet, the former president of Chile, as the first Undersecretary General of the new agency. It's almost beyond belief that a socialist feminist was chosen. I'm stunned that there were no reports of cardiac arrest in the countries steeped in misogyny. For our collective purposes, one of the best things about having UN Women is that we may finally have an agency on which we can rely to take the lead in overcoming the vulnerability of women to HIV. UN Women will immediately become one of the co-sponsors of UNAIDS. In that role, it may be possible to confound the indifference, passivity, and inertia that has constituted so much of the international response. Colombia may finally have a powerful ally in the focus on the M in PMTCT+. Alan would have approved. Third, but rather more mournful, is the calamitous setback for the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. At the recently concluded replenishment conference, none of the targets were reached. Not the goal of $20 billion over 3 years to significantly ramp up the rollout of treatment, prevention, and care. Not the alternative goal of $17 billion to maintain the current trajectory and expand it at the margins. Not the $13 billion that would have secured what is now in place, even if leaving virtually no room for expansion. Instead, the Global Fund received $11.7 billion and now faces a grim funding shortage. And you will permit me to point out that we find trillions of dollars on this planet for stimulus packages, for bailing out banks, for fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, for dealing with terrorism, for dealing with oil spills, but we seem never to be able to find a microscopic smidgen of that money to address the priorities of global public health. And I will never personally understand it, nor countenance it. I imagine myself thinking of what happened at the Global Fund, sitting on the couch in Alan's office, door uncharacteristically closed, intensely discussing what all of it means. He looks at all the options, he always looked at all the options, and agrees, as I know he would, that in the circumstances, no punches should be pulled. And what are the circumstances? Quite simply, significant numbers of Africans in particular living with AIDS are going to die unnecessarily. The shortage of drugs is already felt. An incipient panic is discernible. It may not come to a head until later next year, but to a head it will come. And who will bear the brunt of the criminal default on the promises made by the donor nations, including, I say with bewildered sadness, the United States? Overwhelmingly, African women. They will pay the price. They are the most vulnerable. They are the most disproportionately infected. And I have to ask, with a rage that breaks the surface of analysis, why are the women of Africa so cavalierly expendable? How do you define crimes against humanity? Alan would have wanted an answer. Finally, there is the international contagion of sexual violence and the growing alarm, albeit decades late, about the consequences. Recent studies led by Rachel Jukes and by Charlotte Watts have shown what we all intuited to be true. Whether it's rape in conflict or intimate partner sexual violence, the AIDS virus is transmitted at increased levels of infection. This is where my colleagues and I miss Alan most. The carnage of marital rape, of intimate partner rape, of opportunistic rape, of politically orchestrated rape as in Zimbabwe, of rape as a strategy of war as in the Congo. It's all reached dimensions of madness, and the response at every level ranges from inadequacy to hopeless. In the case of the Congo, for example, the international community has utterly failed to protect the women. The Secretary General of the United Nations, the Security Council, the consortium of 12 UN agencies on the ground, the largest peacekeeping force in the world, nearly 20,000, they all stand indicted. Indeed, in the most recent grotesque episode of mass gang raping in the province of North Kivu that occurred at the end of July, early August, and has been on the front pages of many of the world's most notable newspapers, and I emphasize that this is but one episode in an estimate of 600,000 rapes that have occurred over the last 14 years. The United Nations has publicly admitted that through inaction, it is complicit. All of this would have driven Alan crazy. He would have searched obsessively for solutions. He was so wedded to the principle of gender equality that the abuse of women on such a scale would have scarred his soul. He leaves us a transcendent commitment to women's rights. I see it more clearly now, sadly after his death, as I recognize how much Claire Rosenfield helped to shape Alan's moral core. That moral core is both a legacy and a signpost for the future. I wish you well at the conference. Thank you.
Stephen, thank you. To all of our speakers, thank you so much. You all said it as well as it could have been said. This was an evening of great intellect, great vision, and such important anchoring memories. Tomorrow, our work begins to build on what we all have done to date. Thank you all for coming, and good night.